Welcome to the Barbara Schulte Show with host Barbara Schulte and producer Ben Self. The Barbara Schulte Show brings conversations, stories, and tips intended to power up a writer's potential for more success, fun, and the confidence to ride and live with grace, courage, and the grit to never give up.
In this episode, you'll meet William Lewis from Anderson, Texas. He is a passionate non-pro competitor, show dad extraordinaire, and has been president of Stock Horse of Texas for 4 years. William believes that being the father of two boys who show, being deeply involved in the management of SHOT, and going through the ups and downs of showing himself have given him lots of evolving insights into the non-pro journey. He seeks constant improvement personally and for all SHOT members. Hi, William.
Hello,
welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on a whim.
Well, you were walking by and I
got trapped.
Who is that guy? Pull him in here, Ben. Let's get this guy in here. Let's get this going.
There you go.
Well, I'm delighted that it's working out this way. And before we get going, I have something really serious that I want to ask you.
Yes, ma'am.
Why do you call me the Velvet Hammer?
Well, I don't know, because it fits so good.
Your face is red.
Laura Yarborough came up with that, and
she blamed you.
She did? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't remember how that came about, but it's brilliant, and it's true, because you can hit us like an 8-pound sledge, and we're okay. We don't cry or anything. I don't know. I guess that's why. Uh-huh. But I think it fits.
Yeah, okay.
And you're stuck with it. So is this going to be the Velvet Hammer podcast?
Yeah, the name of this episode is the Velvet Hammer.
The Velvet Hammer. Yeah.
Well, William, tell us a little bit about your background with horses. And
well, I've always said that I'm not an industry guy. We grew up with horses, but we rode horses. We raised cattle, and we were into club calves pretty good, but never got into showing or anything like that. And when I was in college, I got to team roping a little bit and liked it a lot. Did it for quite a few years. Then I guess my kids were born, so I kind of laid off that for a little while. And when they got big enough to kind of walk and go, and I got back into horses. I had a good friend just helped day work with and things like that. He was riding some neat horses, and I was pretty impressed with their ability and his ability. And I said, man, I want to do that too. And got to ride, and he goes, you need to go to one of these SHOT shows. And I said, what are we shooting? Ended up, yeah, so, I don't know, 2 weeks later, ended up in San Angelo, Texas, and that was about 12 years ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, I guess it just kind of evolved like that, and again, I mean, we always had horses. My mom rode, she was a very good horse rider, had some pretty nice horses. Her and Dad always, they liked trail riding and riding a ranch and that sort of thing. She had some pretty good quarter horses, but she'd ride English. My sisters rode English, Hunt Seed and Hunter Jumper and all that. One of my sisters was on the A&M equestrian team. So I never did that. Probably couldn't stay on. I guess I thought I couldn't. But anyway, so we kind of got into the stock horse stuff and then really enjoyed it. And then my boys started kind of following suit a little bit and just kind of got ate up with it and can't stop now. So that and the cow horse has been great, kind of moving into that in a into a more challenging circle of really, really top-end horses. So I guess that's kind of it in a nutshell. So here we are.
So what is it that you love about it so much? Like, why do you do this?
Sometimes I ask that question myself. I think because it's hard. I've always dabbled in lots of little things. I'm one of those guys that can do a little bit of everything, but not a master of anything, as they say. But this kind of grabbed me and just kept staying at it. And it seems like the more I would fail at it, the more I'd just grind at me to go fix that or go figure out how to do better. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if it's ego, you know, just getting beat, you got to go win. And I think that's, as I get attuned to this stuff, I think that that's actually the wrong thing. And I think that doing it because you really enjoy it, and it is a challenge. I mean, that's a fun part of it too. But I think that the ego part is actually in your way. And once you kind of get that out of your way, I think it makes a big difference. And I'm working on it.
Uh-huh.
I'm working on that. So
it really is the love of it that drives it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always enjoyed it, but I don't know. It probably took me a few years till I really started to love it.
Uh-huh.
And that's a really good point, the way you put that.
Uh-huh.
So I think there's a huge difference there.
Well, you get to share it with your boys, and they're just so. How many boys do you have, and how old are they, and what are they doing?
I've got two boys. One's a 19. He's fixing to be 19 this month, actually. And my youngest son's 16. So Christopher's 19, and Will is 16. I think Christopher was when he was old enough. Maybe he was 8. Yeah, I'd be about 8.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to stock horse shows.
Mm-hmm.
And Will followed suit. He might have been 10 or something like that. And it was kind of funny because Christopher was the one we said, man, he just ate up. You couldn't get him off a horse. And I think a horse ran off with Will at the ranch. We were pinning cattle or something one day and when he was little. And he got scared. That kid will never throw a leg over another horse. He's ate up with it now. Ate up with it. So both the boys are, and I'm real proud of them, but I can go on and on about what this industry and what this discipline has done for these kids.
I think you should tell us about that because that's really important, I think.
The work ethic and the discipline that you have to do this and be even remotely successful, I think is pretty rare. Now, I know, I'm sure in other sports it is that way too, but there's an amount of dedication, of persistence that you have. You have to get up every day. You have to do your job every day. Just getting up and feeding horses every morning, we don't think about this as what we do, but millions of people have no idea what that kind of discipline's like, and the kids these days just don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really fortunate to be able to do this and be kind of raised in it. I think that these young people that are doing this sort of thing are going to be very valuable assets when they move off into the work world, whether they're doing this or anything else. They mm-hmm. could do something totally unrelated, but they are an extremely valuable commodity. I'm an employer. I have people, and I understand what work ethic is, and I understand how rare that is.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that to answer your question or to expound on that in a lot of ways, this has done more for their education as young men and contributors to society than secondary education college will ever do.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I don't believe in the secondary education. Not Christopher's going off to school here in the fall. He starts in 2 weeks, I believe.
So where is he going?
Tarleton.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So seems like yesterday I was starting school. I mean yesterday.
Yeah. I think also there has to be this wonderful benefit of you spending time with your boys doing this and going through the ups and downs and the winning and the losing and all those things.
Absolutely. That's a good point, and you nailed it. The losing has probably been one of the biggest things that they'll remember for the rest of their lives is losing and getting back up after you got beat. I'll tell a quick story of Christopher. This was early on. He was in the reining pen at, I think we were in Lubbock. And his horse come through the middle and pulled on him or something. Well, he snatched that horse back got to jerking on her in the arena. The judge whistled him out, and he was embarrassed. And I know I'm telling off on Christopher, and he's probably still embarrassed about it. But I think now, and I got upset with him, and I fussed at him, and he went and apologized to the judge. But I think that little session right there will have more impact on him the older he gets than mm-hmm. anything else I could imagine. Any of the wins. The wins are great, but the losses, that's what would define them as young men. And mm-hmm. that's a big deal. I was really proud of him and how he's evolved from that. So
that's awesome.
Yes, when, ma'am.
And is there a certain philosophy that you have as a family, or the three of you have, about when you guys don't do well, how you support each other?
I guess that, you know, when you do poorly and you come out and you go, well, I did this wrong. Well, if you look at all the maneuvers you made, say, through a reining pattern, well, you're mad because you missed one lead, or you had your horse picked up this one leg and a stop. Okay, guys, yeah, that was bad. Those are things we got to work on. So all that did was give us the information about what's next, what we have to look towards. But let's talk about all the good stuff, too. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to recognize our failings as opportunities to go and this is what we got to work on. How are mm-hmm. we going to get better? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always said, I think it was an old Aerosmith song, he says, you got to lose to know how to win. And that's a fact. Mm-hmm. That is.
Well, every discipline is made up of all these individual pieces that actually flow together. And so the results are dependent upon, you know, putting those, all of the pieces together in the best way that you can. So when there is a major penalty, it doesn't negate all the rest of it. Just like you said, mm-hmm. the challenge is that we're so conditioned to think of it, that the main scorecard is the scorecard of the judge at the end of the day. And of course we all want that. But I think that the people who continue to grow and grow their success is because they have their own scorecard. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't do a beautiful circle in the last run, but I did it today. I messed up a lead. Well, maybe I wasn't paying attention, and actually my horse does a good lead change. But we can't have our self-worth dependent upon only the external results. It's like where our own progress is. And
that's really hard to overcome.
Yes, but it's so key.
It is, and, uh-huh. and you're right. I mean, a 5-cent washer and a space shuttle goes down.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a tidbit, just a little bitty thing, and that's just the way it is. And so mm-hmm. Sure makes us pay attention to details, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, yeah.
So you ride with Ben?
Yes, ma'am. Ride with Ben Baldus. Have for some years now. Both my boys do.
Uh-huh.
Been really good.
Yeah.
Been really good.
What do you enjoy in his program?
I like that I never wanted to be a customer, if that makes sense necessarily, for anybody. I didn't want to be your typical non-pro type, mm-hmm. or what I had visualized as non-pro. I want to be involved in the process. I want to be involved in the team and that sort of thing. And that's how it is over there. You know, I have somebody saddling my horse and that sort of thing. We go over there and we help at the barn. And so what's really cool about it, I guess, is the inclusivity of it. You know, you feel like you're part of the team over there. You go, well, hey, some cattle got out. Go grab your horse and help us pin these cattle, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You're not just you're not at an amusement park riding a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. You're part of the crew. And I think that's been a big deal for me. My sons have had a lot of opportunity to help there and be involved in the process. They've cleaned a lot of stalls. And I'm pushing 50 years old, and one of the things I enjoy most is cleaning stalls. I don't know why. There's some kind of catharsis there.
You know, there's a lot of people that agree with you. No, there's nothing wrong with you. There are a lot of people that agree with you.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it's a good environment, and it's challenging. When we do something right, they let us know. When we do something wrong, they let us know. And I think one of the tougher things about being a non-pro and getting coached, oh, man, I'll get off on a rabbit trail here. But
we love rabbit trails.
Oh, man. For me personally, I've always been able to pretty much hang my ego on the gate when I walk in, if that makes sense. I'm all in. I want to do exactly the right thing because I crave getting better, however you want to define it. And there's these big gray spots that I talk about. So there's this point where you're listening to everything. You're trying to take instructions. You're trying to do well so you get better. But there's a zone in there where you have to start doing it yourself. And so that gray area in between taking instruction and applying it, particularly in, as it pertains to timing, is really hard, especially if you're mechanically inclined, which I kind of am, I think. And so when somebody says, stop for a second, I want you to do this, and they tell you why you're doing it, it's huge. And I think that a lot of people, we all do it. The more we understand something, we take all these other bits and pieces for granted, and we assume that this person speaks the language or whatever it might be. It's like we were talking about earlier. You need to stop straight. And Ben says, you mean keep my back straight? Well, what do you mean? No, your horse straight. Straight with what? So, I mean, it's still, a question I struggle with. Stop straight, but I want you to stop. I need to stop into the cow. What in the hell are you talking about? So, anyway, I think that one of the things I've found with Ben and other good trainers and instructors is they say, this is why we're doing this, and this is what we're going to do, and this is why we're doing it, and this is the result we're working towards. Mm-hmm. And then you go do it, and they say, oh, that was terrible. Do it again. But they can tell you it was terrible, and you get why it was terrible. Instead of just going, just stop, that was terrible, what did I do wrong? Just stop.
Oh, what you really love in instruction, if I'm understanding, is to understand what the goal is, how to do it, you do it, and if it worked or not.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
Why. Understanding the why.
Absolutely. That's, you nutshelled it perfect. Yeah.
What about the tone in coaching?
I don't know. I think it's different for everybody. I'm fairly thick skin, but I still get my feelings hurt, you know, but I get over it. I think tone applied at the right amount of tone at the right time. You know, if you're trying to go circle a cow and the cow's getting in front of you and you're fixing to die and they yell, get to the head, yell, you know. But
it's like kicking.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
It's like adding energy to the instruction.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's right. So tone, I think, is somebody that's good with it applies it as required, applies it as required for the person they're coaching. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can't hear sometimes. I used to train with one guy, and he lived right by some railroad tracks with Steve, and I swear, every time a cow came out his gate, a train would come by. And he's yelling at me. I don't know what he's yelling. And then the train goes by and he goes, what are you doing? I don't know. I couldn't hear anything. And it was just funny, you know, but seemed inevitable. But sometimes you just can't hear. You got to yell at them. And sometimes we're not listening. You got to yell at us, Barb. You got to put the velvet hammer on it.
Yeah, maybe I'll just start selling some velvet hammers.
I think you should. Like a koozie or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Stock Horse of Texas because of how I so admire, and I've told you this every time I see you, I compliment you. You're the president of Stock Horse of Texas.
Yes, ma'am.
And there's something about the decisions that you all make that creates an atmosphere of people feeling comfortable and welcome and supportive of each other and learning. So I want to know what is that philosophy? Like what drives that? Is it values? Is it, you know, because I'm sure challenges are there, just like, you know, every organization has challenges. Like what is it that keeps moving shot in such a great direction even as it grows?
There's a long list of things and that I think attribute to it, and there's a few things that I think that are key to it. And to answer part of your question there, I think that a lot of the folks that are from the board of directors to the volunteers to the members, kind of get it. So if I'm a 5-year veteran of the Stock Horse of Texas, I really understand what that first show person is feeling, is doing, the problems they're having, the challenges, the fear of stage fright and all that sort of thing. So I think that we have a pretty good handle on how it feels to be that guy or that gal walking in the pen for the first time.
Wait, but what, William, what keeps the members of Stock Horse of Texas remembering that? Because in many competitive organizations, it's all about who wins. Mm-hmm. But I think, and I'm sure, you know, the people in Stock Horse of Texas care who wins too, and that's competitive.
They do.
But there's that sense of, you know, we're in it together and we're not going to leave you. Like, what keeps people remembering after 5 years? Because you might be in another organization and forget all about that.
It could be that we don't change the way we treat people from their first day to their fifth day. We try to encourage that camaraderie and that, you know, if I'm at a gate and you're coming out and I've known you for 10 years, I'm going to smile at you just like it was your first day. And I'm going to give you a hard time at the gate, and we're going to make friends, you know. And I think that's part of it. And I think it's, for whatever reason, it's kind of a contagious culture. One of the things I've always kind of joked around about is the thickness of our rule book. It's only a quarter inch thick. And that's a difficult thing to do. I know in our business over the years, when you'd find somewhere, you say, we need to make a rule about this so nobody will do this. And it was always kind of a cultural thing. It wasn't a technical thing about point systems or something like that. And you say, hold on just a minute. Let's talk about our culture a little bit, that we're worried about making more rules about doing something other than trying to encourage people to you know what, have a little patience at the gate. We don't have rules about how you're going to conduct yourself when you're standing at the gate, when there's a 4-H kid that's volunteering, and he's got 60 youth kids plus all their parents standing at the gate. Mm-hmm. So you have to be there, and you have to be part of that, and you kind of have to go, okay, guys, this is how we're going to do it. And if somebody gets upset or something, say, hang on just a minute, it's okay. It's okay. Mm-hmm. And so I guess we try to steer that culture through some leadership. And, you know, it's kind of like if you see Jill, our executive director, walking around picking up a plastic bottle off the grounds, people see that, and they're going to go, you know, I'm going to pick up trash too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably mm-hmm. kind of an example of mm-hmm. that sort of leadership, I mm-hmm. guess, but. Anyway, that's kind of one of my jokes about the thickness of our rule book. I don't want it to get any thicker.
You can always make the font smaller if you know.
They're really fat letters too, okay? Yeah, for blind people like me. But I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, you did. It sounds to me, from what you said, that it's really about thinking about what you want to create instead mm-hmm. of what you want to make sure doesn't happen.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know what? In the whole area of mental skills and high and world-class performance, mm-hmm. it's really always about focusing on what you want rather than the fear of what you feel might happen or what you want to avoid. Knowing, like, the difference, like you just said, like, is this really that important for a rule of what you can't
right.
do? And that's really brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I think that's been a big part of it too.
Uh-huh.
We have a great, our executive director is just absolutely takes 100% ownership of every aspect of our association. I mean, to the
Jill.
Smallest detail. Yes.
She's and the best.
She's tremendous. And she's very detail oriented, but also knows how to delegate. And I think that's pretty unique. It's pretty rare. So we're very lucky to have an executive director like that. She has the trust of our board of directors. She's earned it. And we have a real cohesive board, smart people, people that are very interested in the association and the growth of it, and they're interested in the members.
Mm-hmm.
They walk out and they work a gate, and they want those folks to have a good time. They want them to have a good experience and have some success.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's been a huge deal, and it's kind of an A team. It's delicate, Mm-hmm. But if everybody puts their head down and does it for the right reasons, I want to call it non-selfish reasons, mm-hmm. it's pretty pure.
Yeah.
It's pretty pure.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. It's been really fun.
One of the things I know that you're interested in, because of our conversations over the past couple of years, is this whole high-performance skill aspect. Mm-hmm. And you always say that you have squirrels in your head. You know, Barry sent me a text, and you go, Barb, these squirrels are really bad today.
It's a bag of squirrels.
Yeah. So why do you call it a bag of squirrels?
Well,
and how are you getting them out?
It might just be me, and I'm sure there's other folks, but
it's not just you. I can tell you
okay,
that.
Okay, yeah. So they call it ADD or lack of focus or whatever it is. And what were you talking about? This is a great example. We were at a here we go right there. See, we were at a Mexican place, and we were standing outside the door to eat, and it was Ben and some other friends of ours, and we had ridden all day, and I was looking at the handrail out there. And they have little plastic end caps they put in these handrails. And it was one of them caps that was gone off that handrail. We've been riding horses all day. We've been trying to get better, mind you. So we go in there, we sit down, and we're eating food. And all I can think about is that damn cap that's missing out of that handrail out there, instead of talking about our horses and things like that. And so I have to I have to reel myself back over to focus. But it's basically is about focus. And I guess a lot of us, some are better than others. We have busy lives, and there's so many things we're trying to do at one time. I guess in our minds there are so many things that we have on our plate that, you know, we're riding in the cow pen and saying, well, did I turn the water trough off, or did I order feed, or whatever it might be? And I think those are normal things. But getting those two squirrels in that sack to sit still for a minute so you can go in there and focus on a cow or whatever it is pretty daunting sometimes, and it's pretty damn funny. I mean, but I think that a lot of us struggle from that sort of thing. And that's not just horses. That's life.
Uh-huh. So what do you do to calm those squirrels down or kick them out?
You know, it's hard to not. I have to try to be mechanical about it, like, don't think about that, don't think about that. But sometimes I have to go off by myself. A lot of times, like this event, I love visiting and hanging out and talking about the stuff, but like for the herd work, sometimes I'll go up in the top of the stands 4 or 5 sets before I even go and just sit there and watch and try to let all that stuff, other stuff, go away and try mm-hmm. to just focus on that. I don't want to call it selfish, but sometimes you have to go off by yourself and just try to push all that out, all that peripheral input, I guess, if mm-hmm. you will. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big help.
By the way, that's perfect. I mean, well, first of all, it's great for you because it works for you, but it's just putting yourself in that situation, getting the feel of the pen. That's something that I always did. I love to do that. Love to go early, you know, sit there, pretend, you know, watch the cattle being settled mm-hmm. and then walk through, you know, what cattle would I cut. Or even go through my ritual, pretend like I'm the person walking down there, be in the arena, feel the energy mm-hmm. of the arena, feel like I'm at a show, I'm not at home, you know, I'm not making dinner, I'm not riding my horse at home, I'm here, I'm immersed, and give myself time to do that so that I can relax and do it. So it's mm-hmm. not like I just enter the arena. And so I think that's a really good, really good.
It takes a long time, and it almost seems odd that you would say, well, I'm going to spend an entire 12 hours here just mentally preparing for 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. But it works.
Yes. The first time I was ever a finalist in the Futurity, mm-hmm. I had this really cool horse named Freckle Son of a Dog, and I had been working in Florida with Dr. Lair and about the power of visualization, so first of all, I was doing that at home before I came. But then what I did is when I got to Will Rogers, and it really changed the course of my career, I sat up there and did exactly that for like 5 or 6 sets a day. I was on the 5th day, and I had envisioned having really good runs at home. And I really loved this horse and had a lot of faith in this horse. And but I was in that Coliseum. One set, I focused on the cattle. I focused on, okay, if I would watch the cattle, make my list, and if I was the next cutter, what were the three or four cattle? Mm-hmm. All the way to the end. So I practiced, no matter what my draw was, watching cattle. And then the next group, I didn't watch the cattle. I pretended like I was on my horse doing my ritual in the back. And then I would, you know, put my shoulders back, eyes up, chin up, breathe, like walk to the herd. I would pretend like I was on my horse walking to the herd. I was at the edge of the herd. I was walking through the herd. Yeah, I didn't watch the people cutting,
right?
You know, which is hard, right? Because we want to watch the people. But I put myself in the riding, in the showing riding mode. So I alternated that in groups for 4 days before I showed.
My gosh.
And that was the first time I ever made the finals in Will Rogers. And that whole process really changed. You know, like I kept doing that. It didn't take 4 days. But even on weekends, I would, you know, even if I was like fourth in the open in the first class, I would still really take time to feel like I knew the arena, you know, watch the cattle, not just for the cattle that I wanted, but like what's the energy of the herd? You know, like, are they wild? Are they numb? Are they, you know, what are they? What's the weather like? Is the wind blowing? You know, like just to be present there. And that's so what you're doing is really good.
How did you go about having just one squirrel in your head at that time? So you're talking about
five days. I've never had a squirrel in my head.
You're talking about 5 days of focus. And that probably goes back to your love of the journey and the
mm-hmm.
Talking about earlier.
I have always had a passion for this. Because, you know, the reason I love it so much is because I think it unlocks our joy and our potential. And that's why I love it. And I understand from my training that we have to work at it. And to me, when you learn how to get into that state and you feel really prepared, and like for me, I had gone through, between the visualizations and all those runs, I had gone through, you know, hundreds of runs. So when I got on my horse to ride down to the herd, it felt like old home week, like I had already been there. So it's because it's such a good feeling to be in that place mm-hmm. where you're so focused, but you're still energized. It was effort, so it was energy, so it was work in that way, but it was such good work that, and I knew it was important. And if I wanted to really be a world-class open competitor, I really had to do that. And I just thought it was also fascinating. And, of mm-hmm. course, it goes over into life as well.
100%.
Yeah. So do you you listen to books? Yeah, I think you were telling me before. And so what are some, do you have some tidbits for us? Or some things you've learned over the different people?
I never seem to remember any particular quotes from them too much, but I think that a lot of those books you listen to, you take away a frame of mind or kind of a lesson from the book. Can't tell you that one I'm listening to right now. I'm going to say that one. There was one I listened to. It was called Extreme Ownership. And it was written by a couple of Navy SEALs. And it was pretty cool because they put together all their, I think they were in Iraq and Afghanistan. They were in a few places. But they would talk about their missions and how these missions applied to ownership of problems. And if you look at that in its purest sense, it was pretty simple. There's no excuses. So if something happened, there's no blame. And I think that was a huge deal I took away from that. And I still push that on my sons is, and they say, well, that cow was bad, or, well, the judge, you know, he should have marked me different, or I was late because I forgot to set my alarm, whatever that might be. And if you start thinking about taking ownership of those sort of things, well, hell, I told one of my employees the other day, he said, the power went out and the cell phone didn't go off. I said, well, you need a battery charged. I mean, a battery alarm clock too. But if we really look at that and question the excuses that we make or the reasons we say that something happened to us, it's not just applies in the show pen. I mean, it applies to everything you do. And so, you know, I'm listening to this stuff, a lot of it because I want to be better in the show pen. A lot of it, I want to be better at running my business. I want to be better with my family, whatever it might be. But it all crosses over. So that was one of the deals that was a great book. It was neat. And it was pretty cool because they had war stories. And then, you know, you listen to a war story and then they apply it to, they have a consulting business where they go around and get all these executives kind of squared away with their people and their crews and things like that. And that's been a big deal to me, trying to run a business and have a good culture in my company as well. You know, it seems like you get, the older you get, the more you know, and you wish you knew it 20 years ago. But
I think that's because the journey is, yeah. It's about the journey.
Yep.
That's because there'll be things in 20 years that we wish we'd known now.
I know. We'll think we're dumb 20 years from now. Damn, what the hell was I thinking at 50?
Yes. I think you'll enjoy, we have an episode where we talk to a couple of veterans. You know, the NCHA, the National Cutting Horse Association, had an event with a veteran paired with a youth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a very spectacular event. And a trainer, they each team had their own trainer. And when we interviewed the veterans, they talked a lot about, well, one was a sniper.
Mm-hmm.
And talked about how in the military you're trained like intensely for a mission, and absolutely there are no excuses. And
yes.
And one of the reasons that Paul, one of the vets, liked cutting was because it reminded him of his training, that you had to be like aware of your buddy, you had to be aware of looking out here, you had to be aware of the weather, you had to be aware of like five or six things. And there wasn't room for error. And that one of the hardest things when veterans get out of the military is that they don't have anything that's that intensely focused driven, like in work or something, mm-hmm. where they can go into, and they've spent all these years doing that. But anyway, that was really interesting. And the other thing I just wanted to comment on what you said is that blame... Well, in the whole thing of being in the zone and being real clear about what you're about to do and having, you know, a level of high positive but not frenetic energy focus but calm, well, that's the state you want. There's a hierarchy of emotions of what's the most important of that. And there's also a hierarchy of negative emotions and which ones are the most disempowering. When you're in that state, it's the hardest to get back to the positive state, and the most disempowering is blame.
Is that right?
Because blame, like if you just think about if you're in that really great high performance state and you're like on it and focused and you feel good and you feel your horse and you know that there's nothing else that you could have done that day, that you could have been better prepared. So you're just going to go in and give it all you've got and let the chips fall, which is really ideal to not focus on the outcome. But if that's what you're after, then when you think about blame, you don't have any energy. Because usually when you're blaming, it's a really low negative state of energy. You're not taking responsibility for it. It's like, well, it was out of my control, you know, like it was this other reason for it. And you don't take any responsibility. So it's really the polar opposite of what you want to do. And what's interesting about it is that it's, for many people, it's the most comfortable.
Yes,
you know, if I don't have any responsibility, then it's easy. You know, how could anybody, you know, be competitive in these cattle, in these conditions?
Right.
Well, everybody has the same conditions.
So. I think it's a human condition, and we all I want to do it. The first thing I want to do is go, well, that would have been better if this happened. Hold on just a minute. You can't, that's what we gravitate towards as humans, just our inclination. I don't know if it's laziness or what it might be, but it's a way out. It's a way out. Horses hunt that easy spot.
Yes,
they learn that, right? I'm not sure how to show it to them all the time, but...
Yeah, that's our job, is to make the release the easy spot.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tell me, I think that you like to look at horses and trade horses around, right? Is that true, William?
It's kind of on accident, sort of. I think I stumble into some of this stuff.
You going to blame something? No. I'm not taking responsibility for this horse trade.
I'm not taking responsibility for this good deal I made once in my life on a horse.
By the way, I have a friend that says he wants to lose money as slowly as possible in the horse business.
Boy, he nailed it. Well, I was joking the other day that we've worked really hard in our business and our lives, and if the kids get done riding horses and we don't have anything left, I'm okay with that. It's been huge. But what was the question?
The question was about horse trading.
Oh. Well.
If you liked the horse trade, kind of what? Just tell us a little bit about it. Is that true?
I had some luck. I think that I probably don't give myself enough credit sometimes. You know, you question your decisions and things and question your eye for a horse, your feel for a horse. But there was one in particular that was kind of back in the filly pasture, and I was kind of looking for a horse, and I wasn't looking for a futurity horse. Rode around at Ben's and liked her a lot, and what's the deal on this horse? He said, well, she's for sale. You want to go futurity? I said, well, I think I came up to ride bridle horses or something. I said, yeah, why not? Let's do it. And she was muddy and long-haired and dirty and all this, and the story's longer, but fast forward, she ended up winning the non-pro futurity here at Fort Worth, and
wow. With you?
No, not with me. I had to sell her. But luckily, I was able to buy her back. But, so about 3 months before the futurity, I injured my arm. Very unexciting manner. I just tore up my arm, so I couldn't ride anyway. So I had to sell her, but ended up that she did well. And so we had some success there and got her back and sold her again. So none of this is with a plan. Uh-huh. So I guess if I didn't plan it, I don't give myself credit for really doing anything right there. But I think that I did more planning than I thought, or I gave myself credit for. Uh-huh. We sure looked to some good folks for help. And I think whether we realize it or not, it's given us more of a plan than we wrote down on paper, you know. Uh-huh. It seemed like everything I write on paper, I lose. I got stuff written everywhere, and now I can't find that. But anyway, we've had a good time. The 3-year-old thing's been really fun. Just been doing it a couple of years, but
I think didn't you just win the go round today?
No, that was yesterday. Christopher, my son, he won the herd work in the Derby.
Oh wow!
In the non-pro Derby this morning.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, real big deal. It was great. We're real proud of him. That horse was real sick here about 2 months ago, and so he's back. Uh huh. But we went out of the herd last night in the non-pro futurity, and my joke was it was very successful. We didn't fall off, and we didn't lose a cow. I think that circles back to something you stated earlier is my litmus test, is that right, for success is totally different than what it was a few years ago. And we joke about not falling off, but I think I did the same thing in Tennessee. Went out and we drug a lead, a whole circle out there, but the rest of the run was great. I was like, I walked out, I said, it's no big deal. Drug a lead, we can fix that. I did all this other stuff that's really hard, and we did well. We were uh-huh. fine. So uh-huh. it used to be that all I think about is I drug that lead. Uh-huh. I just want to jump off a cliff, and uh-huh. I don't do that anymore.
Yeah, so, that's awesome.
Well, that's some of the stuff I learned from you guys and the way your mental picture of mm-hmm. this, of mm-hmm. how we look at what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so how do we define success? Well, the joke is not falling off, I guess, for a non-pro. I'm an aspiring horse rider, not an aspiring horse trainer.
Well, I would say you're pretty successful. Yeah. I know you did well today in the 3-year-old.
Yes, ma'am. It was real close to today. It was real close. It was almost midnight, but we got it done.
It was under the midnight hour.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. It was fun. Real happy about that. But that's kind of my horse trading. Buy high, sell low.
I don't think you're the only one that does that.
I suspect not.
My dad always said that the secret to making money with horses was buying low. That's what he said. But that was his business, too.
Right, right.
Yeah. He had always done what most of us do in the performance horse world. He wouldn't have made it. But
yeah. So. Well, you know, I was talking to somebody earlier. We were talking about horses and buying and selling and trading up and building these horses and selling them. And I said, well, growing up, you know, we had horses. That's your horse. He says, you want to buy it? That's my horse. You can't buy my horse. And we never thought of that as moving those horses. It's kind of like just a dog or something. And so it seemed like most of the horses I ever owned growing up, they died at home.
Yeah.
They didn't go anywhere else. And now somebody, you know, we have a nice horse, and somebody says, you know, would you like to sell your horse? And there's this struggle. That's my horse. Uh-huh. But the other part of it is, why are we doing this? What are we going to? Uh-huh. We're trying to get better, and we're trying to build a better horse every year, and you can't do that with 50 horses in the barn. So mm-hmm. at least I can't. So.
Yeah. Well, so what are you going to do the rest of the year? What are your plans?
We're going to we're working towards the Snaffabit Futurity. Mm-hmm. I am personally. We got I have one that I'm showing the non-pro, and we've got one that showed in the open yesterday, I believe. First time out that we raised this horse, and he's really nice, and we'll see how he does. But sure enough, try to come to the Snaffabit and not fall off.
I bet you're going to accomplish that.
Yeah.
That's pretty exciting, being homegrown. That's
yes, ma'am.
Great.
Yeah, he's neat. That was pretty fun. And something else I never planned on doing, but we had a good mare, and everybody kept saying, why don't you breed her? And I said, well, okay. And uh-huh. we've got three babies out of her, and start talking about embryo stuff and maybe some ICSI stuff even in the fall. But so, again, not having a plan, but it sounds fun, so let's do it.
Good.
So we're going to do that. We get the boys. We got one going off to college. I think he's looking at trying to go out for the ranch horse team at Tarleton, so we'll get to look forward to that, especially at stock horse shows. So I'll still be showing with him, uh-huh. hopefully more. No, we'll still uh-huh. do the stuff. So he'll be kind of derby level. Then my youngest son, he's going to be doing the youth stuff and moving into the youth fence next year, I think.
I know he's excited.
Oh, yeah, he's ate up.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, he's doing a good job.
Your boys are great, William. You've done a great job.
Thank you. That's quite a compliment. So those are kind of our goals there, and just kind of see what happens. We got two-year-olds starting. We'll have three-year-olds next year. So
you've got it bad, William.
Oh, it's just bad. It's
you've
bad.
Got it really bad.
It's a bad drug. Yeah. I have a serious problem.
Yeah. You better teach your sons to have a good business.
Yeah. Yeah, when I stop paying those entry fees, they're going to figure that out. No, they're doing good. I mean, they're starting to participate in that more and more, and starting to figure out, I mean, just doing entries and stuff like that. And, you know, you want some money at a show, you better put it in a coffee can because you're going to need it for the next one if you want to go show.
Uh-huh. Good and, for you.
So I think they're getting a feel of that.
Yeah. So good.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, thank you for allowing us to grab you
off
the street. You grabbed you and you go, what?
What do y'all want? Very, very happy to be here with you. I'm super flattered to be sitting here with you, Barb. Huge. One of my heroes. I know the other day when you called me, Trump was on the other line. I hung up on him. I had to talk to you. So I got to go. Barb's on the line.
That's right.
That's right. That's
good.
Right.
Well, you're the best, and continue to keep up the good work with Stock Horse of Texas and your riding and your boys, and have a good time. And
yes, ma'am. Well, we'll continue to follow your lead.
Okay. So we'll be rooting you on. Thanks again.
Oh, Lord, thank you, ma'am.
Now, just after this interview, William finished fifth in the non-pro finals on his three-year-old at the Southwest Rain Cow Horse Pre-Futurity Show. He was thrilled. William is making the journey for youth, amateurs, and non-pros an adventure based on camaraderie, fun, knowledge, and character. Thank you for listening, And until next time, have fun, love on your pony, and never stop believing. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to The Barbara Schulte Show. If you have enjoyed this episode, subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Instagram to stay tuned for future episodes.